Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
I'm quietly confident you're going to like today's guest. One of the reasons I think you'll like her is because she is about to outperform all of our previous guests put together in terms of sheer range. Victorian London? Pah. The Roman walls? Meh. This guest is going to deliver a history of London starting in the Cretaceous era. And if you like what you hear, well, what we didn't get a chance to say in the original recording is that you can hear our guest talk on the 9th of September at 7:30 at the Doodle Bar in Battersea, which is a little bit upstream from where the hippopotamus is currently living, where you can treat yourself to a confection of poetry and guerrilla ecology, courtesy of Tom Chivers, Dan Raven Ellison, and my guest today, Victoria Herridge. It's all part of Totally Thames. Back to the present day, and we're off to South Kensington, the present day being the 5th of September 2014, and this being Londonist Out Loud.
Hey baby, let me take you down to a place of strange sights and sounds you ain't never seen the light before, just a stone's throw from your front door.
Well, hello, hello, listener, I've got a confession. I have wanted to get into this building for quite a while, and finally my wish has come true. I am in a building where I'm told there are 300 odd scientists. And indeed, coming back of house here, I've just seen a couple of fossils. I'm here with Dr. Victoria Herridge Torrey, who is, I need to nail down exactly what you do here.
I'm a paleobiologist and I work here, and my particular research specialism is the evolution of dwarf elephants on islands. But more broadly, I'm interested in the Ice Age and the animals that live there.
Now, the listener will have noticed something rather unusual in the middle of that introduction, and it's surely the dwarf elephants on islands business.
Yeah, quite. Well, surprisingly, they're very, very common, or they were. They're all extinct now, but back in the Ice Age, so across the last 2.5 million years or so, when elephants and mammoths found themselves on islands like Sicily, Malta, Sardinia, Crete, Cyprus, they always did the same thing, evolutionarily speaking. They always evolved to become smaller. So there were these ancestral, big fossil elephants, like the straight-tusked elephant, which was all over Europe, weighed about 10 tonnes, was 4 metres tall. As I said, it was everywhere, including the UK. So there we've got straight-tusked elephant fossils from places like Clacton-on-Sea, for example, just off the A13 on your way down to Southend, near to Thurrock Lakeside. Got some there too. But these massive elephants, when they got to islands like Sicily, they would sometimes become as small as just 1 metre tall as adults, weighing under 100 kilograms. So that is a very, very, very small elephant. In fact, it kind of turns the idea of what we think about an elephant on its head. I mean, you have these kind of dwarf elephants and mini mammoths, and it gets a bit oxymoronic.
So when you say you're into dwarf elephants, really what you're saying is you're into elephants from that period?
Yep, so I know about elephants that are big, mammoths that are big. I guess I am most interested in the small ones because they tell us so much about the way evolution works, and that is what interests me. But you cannot get away from this incredible lost world that was Ice Age Europe, and Ice Age Britain is a great example of that.
Now, look, you know the agenda here is London-centric, and sometimes I have to weigh out whether it's a good idea to go off track early. And I know that the question, why did elephants get smaller when they went on to... I know that's going to take us off beam pretty quickly, but I've got to. Can we do it in a way that's going to bring us back to the subject of London?
Yeah, I mean, the shortest answer is we aren't exactly sure why. We've got a few ideas. We think it's to do with the island environment, because it's always islands that you have dwarf elephants on. And of course, that becomes interesting because Britain, we think of today as an island, but it didn't have any dwarf elephants or dwarf mammoths on it. So that in itself is quite fascinating. But the fundamental thing about islands is that they are different from the mainland. They're smaller and there's a separation between them and the mainland. So animals living there had to have got there in the first place. And that creates a unique set of ecological circumstances. There are usually no or very few predators, and there are a lot fewer individuals and species overall, which means the animals living there have a different ecological setting. So if you're an elephant on the mainland, being big is great because it's a good anti-predation strategy, but it has its downsides. It means it takes you a long time to grow up, a long time to have babies, a long time for your babies to grow up. So from an evolutionary perspective, being big has its problems because you're going to pass on fewer genes to the next generation. But if being big is a great way to stay alive and have babies, then it kind of works for you. Put an elephant in a situation with no predators and fewer competitors, then sometimes it can evolve out of that big body size niche towards a smaller size, which may mean, generally speaking, it can pass on more genes to the next generation because smaller animals tend to grow up faster and have more babies more often.
Does that suggest then that the UK was connected to the mainland? Were we a peninsula at the time or something?
For a lot of the Ice Age, yes, that's exactly the case. So really, Britain as we know it, an island, only really came into being about 400,000 years ago or so. Now, that was just after the end of one of the biggest glaciations to hit the world. So this Ice Age, because I should probably clarify at this point, actually, Ice Age is one of those terms we use in many different settings. So broadly speaking, we're in an Ice Age right now. We've got ice at the poles, but we're in what's called a warm stage within that. So we have interglacials, which are warm stages, and glacials, which are cold stages, and that's when the ice sheets really expand. Now, 450,000 years ago was a really extreme glaciation, and the ice sheets at the North Pole and across the Northern Hemisphere were really enormous, and they reached as far south as Hornchurch and Finchley Road. So I always like to think now, when I look at the overground map of London, that sort of northern edge going around between sort of, you know, West Hampstead and all the way through down to sort of Hornchurch, you can get there. It's almost like you're going along the edge of an incredibly large ice sheet. If you look out of the window, you should see in your mind's eye kilometres thick wall of ice and a polar desert all around.
Are you serious that the Ice Age knocked on the door of London in that way?
Yeah, so I mean we see that today in the geology. So the gravel pits that are quite common across London and Essex, where we still dig out gravel to this day, and lots of things like sort of the brick pits, so the things like, yeah, which gave rise to the beautiful London Stock. Those are sand pits, which are sands and loesses that were laid down by the sedimentation coming off the grinding of these big ice sheets like that. So we still sort of, you know, we've got the remnants of it that we can pick up. And really fascinating, I mean, we laugh about things like it being at Finchley Road and Hornchurch and places like that. But of course, we find the evidence for these past periods when we dig, and quite often those digs are the result of massive industrial activities, so like Crossrail and things like that. That's when things come to light, right the way through from the origins of the London Underground right the way through to the present day. Big industrial scale projects always turn up these really interesting surprises and help us reconstruct the world. But this big ice sheet, which came all the way down to London, and obviously much further across North America and across the Baltics and places like that, when you've got that much ice frozen up in an ice cap, it's of course going to have an effect on the sea level. And so sea level would have to be much lower. It's like the inverse we worry about with global warming and the ice sheets melting.
Now, so there's only so much water at any given point.
Yeah, you've got a closed system in the world, and if you freeze the water up, it's not entering back into the water cycle, and the sea levels will drop. And so at that point, the sea level was much, much lower. And so Britain was connected to the mainland. But interestingly, even before then, when it was warmer, it was still connected to the mainland. And this gets a bit complicated, but it's because there was a ridge of chalk that ran from Calais to Dover. If you've been to France, you can see the White Cliffs of Dover coming back, and you should be able to see the White Cliffs in the other direction as well. That used to be a continuous ridge. Now, that massive ice sheet 450,000 years ago was actually emptying its water into this big glacial lake that was dammed up behind this chalk ridge between France and the UK. And when finally that massive ice sheet melted, that glacial lake breached that bridge and caused a catastrophic mega flood that ploughed its way through the geology and gouged out the English Channel. And it's only after that event that Britain became an island in subsequent warm stages.
Okay, listener, the presenter thinks, how do we bring this back to London? And I think I've got a way. You mentioned Crossrail. Somebody I was speaking to at the Crossrail dig was talking about the amber deposits that they found in one of the shafts that they dug, and the suggestion that there was a forest where London currently is. What I wondered is if we could do a history of London before London.
Yes. Yeah, well, quite. I mean, so it started, I imagine the amber, I don't know for sure because I haven't heard the episode, but I'm guessing the amber is much, much older than the fossils that I generally work on. So in London, in the southeast of England, at the bottom what you have is chalk mostly, and that was laid down, I think, in the Cretaceous. We should probably check that. But then above that is a layer of thick clay that was laid down in a period we call the Eocene.
Can we? Is there any way we've got of? My favourite example of the life of the Earth is if you stretch your arms out. This is a Bill Bryson one. If you stretch your arms out and then shave off the end of one of your fingernails, then the proportion of your stretched arms that represents is mankind. And it often strikes me, actually, when we talk about Doctor Who or time travel or things like that, that if he were to pop up at random, he'd essentially arrive in a place full of rocks, and that's probably it for most of the planet's history.
Yeah.
But, for example, the Cretaceous, when is that?
We're talking about the last sort of 65 million years onwards, really.
Can we go back in percentage of the life? The life of the Earth.
You're asking me to do maths I can't do off the top of my head. What's that out of 4.6 million? It's the total life of the Earth. I'm having to get my phone out right now. This is very, very shameful. If only I could do instantaneous maths. Right, so... calculator. How many zeros? So you've got 4.6 billion. So that's American billion. So 1, 2, 3...
Live maths, listener.
I know, it's really thrilling, isn't it? Live maths on an iPhone.
The answer is 7.
To the minus 8. So 10 to the minus 8, so that's 0.00000007%. So less than 1%, I think we could say here. The Earth has been around for a long time. So yes, we're talking about even that large number of 65 million years is a tiny percentage of the total time that the world has been around.
Well, I just need a moment then, because there's smoke coming out of my ears at that thought. Yeah. That's incredible.
Obviously, there was life around for... I mean, we're talking about the beginnings of the world, and then life came a bit later, quite a lot later, actually. But this still is like a blip, if you like, that we've got here. But that's the very, very basis, these chalks that were laid down. And that was, you know, laid down in a kind of a sea environment. So the chalks and things like that are all these kind of micro organisms and shells and things like that have all been laid down to create that white chalky substance. And within that we get things like flint, which is good to remember because that comes important as an important sort of material resource for the humans that come in at the end. Now on top of that we get a period about sort of, you know, 50 to 30 million years ago called the Eocene, when at that point there was a shallow tropical sea sort of lying over London and the surrounding areas, and that laid down this clay which we call now the London clay. It's the London clay. At that time, you imagine the fossils we find are quite rare because it was mostly a shallow sea, but at the edges, sometimes monkeys turn up and sort of small mammals. But quite often, it's marine stuff we find, fishes and stuff like that. And so there's some beautiful Eocene fish that turn up on places like the Isle of Sheppey in Kent. You follow the Thames out in the midway up to the sea. And then on top of that stuff, actually, everything above that is much more recent. And these are the gravels, mostly, that were laid down by the various ice ages that swept over London. And actually, a lot of them are fairly young. So it's, you know, quite a big hiatus of time, which is interesting in itself, and I can't explain that. So we sort of jump from this Eocene period of like up to 30 million years, right up almost effectively to the present day, to the last million years or so.
that's nearly the present day for you.
Pretty much. I mean, the animals start to become familiar. I'm in my comfort zone because the numbers are small enough that my brain can cope with them. And humans, or at least human relatives, were around. And that's, for me, when it gets really fascinating, because the world is enough like the present day that I really feel that it can inform the way we understand the world around us at the moment. And it has a direct relevance to reconstructing the story of our own species and, you know, how we came to be and what we were doing at that time.
Wow. That's fantastic. We've done a lot of London history. We've done a lot of Georgian London history. We've never done the pre-London London history.
There's lots of it, and I'm probably not the best person to talk to about the humans, because I'm sort of a fossil mammal expert, and whilst humans are mammals, it's quite a separate discipline, relying a lot on sort of the archaeology of the humans themselves, because human fossils are really, really rare. And so there's so very few have been found across the world in total, and of course, for Britain, that means there's only a tiny number. So what we often have to rely on to understand those past humans that were living here is the traces they left behind and the stone tools they made and the cut marks they left on the animals that they ate and things like that. So we know that they were here, but we don't necessarily have the greatest insight into the types of people that they were, except from what the culture, what their culture says about them, which I suppose is in some ways rather beautiful. But bringing it back to London, I mean, that I mentioned earlier, that massive ice sheet, I mean, that was a really important event in the history of London. I mean, the prehistory of London, but also the history of London, really, because it was that massive ice sheet that fundamentally changed the course of the River Thames. So before that big glaciation, the River Thames actually flowed, it actually flowed north through St Albans and came out at around sort of in the coast of Norfolk, and was really just a tributary of the Rhine flowing into the North Sea. But so you can imagine this massive ice sheet coming down right the way to Finchley Road. It cut off that path and it forced the River Thames to change its course and flow southwards and flow along the valley that it has today.
So are we thinking of the Wash as being the former Thames estuary?
Yeah, I guess so. Although it would have, you know, if you, and there was also another river they call the Bytham River, which came out around there. And these were two really important rivers for an earlier stage of human occupation. So another thing you have to understand about what we call the Ice Age, I mentioned these warm stages and cold stages, but they happen in a kind of rhythm. So every 100,000 years, you've got a shift from a warm stage to a cold stage. Now, mostly the warm stages are quite slim blips in this generally cold pattern. So we're currently in a warm blip. But because you've got this rhythmic pattern, it means that there were periods of time when Britain was a lovely place to be, nice and warm, like today, maybe sometimes even slightly warmer. And then there were big periods of time when it was not a pleasant place to be at all, when the ice sheets came down and covered pretty much all of North and the Midlands, leaving southern Britain open, but mostly a bit of a polar desert and not a great place for humans to live in. So in one of those previous warm stages, we had the earliest evidence of humans in Britain about 800,000 years ago, slightly older, when they got these footprints they found at a place called Haysborough in Norfolk, which are in these kind of earlier warm stage sediments that show that people were there then. They've got some stone tools as well, but they haven't yet found any fossils. So we know that people were there. We don't know what species of people, what kind of ancient human, because we've only got their traces.
Right, is this where there seems to be a little bit of controversy going on at the moment around Neanderthal, and is it Homo sapiens?
Our species, modern humans, is called Homo sapiens. Neanderthals are called Homo neanderthalensis. They are our close cousins, and they've been around in Europe for quite a while. And modern humans didn't really leave Africa until maybe 120,000 years ago or thereabouts, and then we came in and maybe had a few early excursions at that point, but only really properly made it into Europe proper in the last sort of 40, 50, 60,000 years. And then of course there's this big debate as to what happened when humans and Neanderthals met. Now, we know they interbred from their DNA. You and I probably have somewhere between 1% and 4% Neanderthal DNA in us. Most people outside of Africa do. So we know that there was some interbreeding, but yet the Neanderthals went extinct, their culture disappeared, and we don't have any any remnants of Neanderthal-type skeletons after a certain point, which I think is about 30,000 years ago. But those dates are quite controversial, and I'm not sure what the controversies you're talking about, so...
Well, I've read a few bits and pieces. I thought there was a bit of controversy as to whether we polished them off or whether something else altogether happened, and the length of time over which the two were exposed to one another. And also there seemed to be a bit of alarm about the idea that we'd interbred in the first place, which came out not so very long ago.
No. I mean, for a long time, it was a kind of a big debate as to whether or not we interbred. And then the original evidence that people got from the ancient DNA suggested that we didn't interbreed. But that was because they were only looking at mitochondrial DNA, which is only ever going to tell you the story of mother to daughter, mother to daughter, mother to daughter, because effectively your mitochondrial DNA you get from your mum. And mum's only ones who pass it on, so dads don't pass it on. So you only get half the story. So when you looked at the mitochondria, there wasn't any evidence that Neanderthals and modern humans were interbreeding. But when they finally were able to sequence the whole genome, so all the DNA, the nuclear DNA as well, then there was evidence that modern-day humans have got Neanderthal genes in them, which is quite fascinating. So that indicates they definitely met. They definitely interacted. It doesn't really get us any closer to talking or to maybe fully understanding why Neanderthals went extinct and were we responsible. And then the question becomes very broad. I mean, what do we mean by responsible? I mean, are we talking? Yeah, I mean, people often think sort of full-out warfare. We can't see any evidence for that. I mean, I don't know where you'd look for that sort of thing. But of course, competing for resources in a really difficult landscape. All these things are going to be important. And talking about where and sort of getting out your sort of handle on that. Is going to come down to sort of the fine resolution of dating, and as those dates shift their ways around, different sites getting different dates, and of course the argument progresses.
It sounds to me like there's potentially an interesting angle on the ongoing immigration debate there, but the bigger debate, and I know that we haven't got time to go into all the various points of contention on this one, but the global warming one is probably worth touching extremely fleetingly, and the man-made component of that. What's your view?
Well, all of the evidence suggests that temperatures are going up, and there's basic scientific consensus that the world is warming and it seems to be anthropogenic in its cause, so humans are responsible. I don't think that changes the more fundamental question, which is what do we do about it? I mean, there's the science, which I think is pretty much incontrovertible. There's a lot of, you know, sort of debate about the minutiae, about what might happen, but I think the basic physics is there. We're pumping CO2 into the atmosphere. That's a greenhouse gas. The world is going to warm up. The effects of it, we're still trying to understand. And then the effects of what that means for humans and how we respond to that is another separate level altogether. And I think that's where the discussion has to take place. People need to decide what they value and what they want. On a slightly separate issue, whether you're a climate change sceptic or not, I think it's incontrovertible that humans change the face of the planet. We know that from looking at the way we affect the world around us through, you know, cutting down forests, changing the environment. And in some ways, that effect of humanity is even more pressing than sort of the broader effects of global warming. And so my immediate fears are really about the biodiversity of the world and the fact that we've got these incredible creatures in it today, like elephants, for example, which are really, really rare and really, really precious and special. And if we don't look after their environment, which is disappearing at a rate that's so fast, then we will lose those animals and we will regret that. Now, I know we will regret that because I can see how people respond when they try to imagine an Ice Age Europe, which was full of animals that today we'd associate with the African savannah. So if you were to go back 125,000 years ago and walk along the banks of the Thames, you would see straight-tusked elephants, you would see cave lions, you would see hyena, you would see hippopotamus, for example. In London, they were here. And it's the same throughout the whole of Europe. These incredible animals, rhinos. We had rhinos here. You know, of course, you have the, you know, really iconic things like the woolly mammoth, which is your iconic Ice Age animal. I mean, great herds of incredible animals, all gone now. Now, it was either the climate change or the presence of humans or both that caused the disappearance of all these incredible animals from Europe. And people still miss them. You know they do. They want to bring them back. Whenever you talk about mammoths, the first thing people ask you is, are you going to clone a woolly mammoth? And it's because people want to see them. But what's so insane about that is that, well, you know, you've got two living elephant species. The closest thing we have today to a mammoth is the Asian elephant. And we've still got it, but it's very, very rare. And if we look at what happened to the woolly mammoth across the world, we, you know, whatever the cause of its extinction was, because there's a debate as to whether it was all climate or humans or both, whatever the cause was, we can see from the patterns that this is what happened. The woolly mammoth was everywhere. Huge herd of them. Millions of woolly mammoths. And then bit by bit, those massive herds contracted into small little pockets. And one by one, these little pockets of mammoth populations winked out like that. Until finally, there was one remnant population on a tiny island off the coast of Siberia called Wrangel Island 4,000 years ago. So actually very recently, the pyramids had been built. But this one tiny island, there was this last population of woolly mammoths still clinging on. Then they were gone. Now, at the moment, what you see across Asia with the Asian elephant, that used to be everywhere, you know, all the way across Eurasia, India, into China, Indonesia. If you look at the present day distribution, that big, big, big wide population of many, many Asian elephants is now just a small number of tiny pockets of elephants isolated from one another, and we're still encroaching on them. And the lesson from the mammoths is that if we aren't careful, we're going to lose those too. But we could stop it from happening.
Well, the obvious.
We've gone off London here, haven't we, again?
We've gone off London, yes, we have. I think we'll forgive that, though, because we're dealing with the things that are the most fundamental and important. What you said about the evolutionary advantage of being big for elephants is definitely in the negative column.
Absolutely.
For them, isn't it? Because it presumably only takes one or two poachers
exactly.
to slip in under the net and
exactly.
They're gone.
Exactly. I mean, if you're, then they breed slowly, their populations can't bounce back quickly. For that reason, they're very, very vulnerable. Yeah, it's very sad. But it's sad, but it's not hopeless. And that's the thing to remember, it's not hopeless. And I think if you've ever had a kind of a dream of going on safari or just enjoying those kind of wonderful images of a world filled with animals, I think as humans we really value diversity and difference. And I don't think anyone really wants to live in a world that's a bit samey and boring. And so it's worthwhile preserving it. And it may feel far away sometimes, but it really isn't.
Londonist Out Loud is sponsored by Audible. To claim your free audiobook from a range of 60,000 titles, try the Audible service on 30-day free trial. Audiobooks can be saved as MP3s and played on your compatible phone, tablet, or desktop, or burned to CD, and they're yours to keep. For your free audiobook, go to www.audible.co.uk/Londonist and click through.
You're listening to Londonist Out Loud. I'm N. Quentin Wolfe. We're at the Natural History Museum. My guest today, Dr. Victoria Torrey. Heritage, and we've been talking about endangered species. And Tori, you've been cultivating and promoting and reviving an endangered species. I think it's an endangered species, the female paleontologist. First of all, congratulations on doing what you're doing. Secondly, congratulations on the incredible name. And you mentioned before we started recording that you're fond of a pun.
Yeah.
The organisation is called Trowel Blazers,
yeah,
which is a work of genius. And there's some pictures on the front of the website, and they are female scientists from across the years. Some of the photos are those very old, sort of mid-Victorian ones, where in fact the lady in the picture looks a lot like a fossil herself. Some of the others are more modern, and you've got the Amelia Earhart types, and people with their heads in ditches and all sorts of stuff going on. What is the scope of Trailblazers?
Trailblazers is a website that aims to highlight the contributions of women to the trowel-wielding fields of geology, paleontology and archaeology. Gardening as well, I suppose, could come into it if anyone wants to submit, but no. Because one thing that I came across as part of my own research, which really surprised me, was that the number of women working in these fields at a very early stage, because these are all very young sciences, were much, much greater than I realised. Now, my own research in the Mediterranean has involved following in the footsteps of one particular pioneering paleontologist called Dorothea Bate. Now, I use her archives, like her old diaries and her old maps, to go and find the places that she worked, where she found the fossils we've got here in the museum today that I work on, so I can go back to those places and bring modern methods to bear on the places she worked at to kind of try and get some more information about how old these fossils were. And in doing so, of course, I started to get to know Dorothea Bate a bit better. You can't help it when you read her diaries and things like that. But I always had this idea in my mind that she was this extraordinary, remarkable woman. I mean, think of that. She first came to the Natural History Museum in 1898 when she was just a teenager, I think she was 19 years old. She walked up to the front door, I mean, this is the Victorian times, and she demanded to see the curator of birds. And he saw her. She asked him for a job and he said no. But she wouldn't leave. She started sorting bird skins, and eventually he saw that this was not some flippity gibbet who didn't know what she was talking about. She really knew her stuff. And because she impressed him so much, they started a correspondence, and he supported and encouraged her. And in 1901, in her early 20s, she went off to Cyprus on her first solo expedition. Quite extraordinary at that time, and so I was like, wow, imagine that, really, really contravening the idea of the Edwardian and Victorian woman, really brave, so unusual, look at that, breaking down the bastions of the male establishment. And that was a really beautiful story to tell, and it really resonated with everybody I told it to, except it wasn't actually correct, because when she was on her next trip, which was to Crete in 1904, on that trip, she happened to go by the excavations at a place called Gornia, which is one of the most important Minoan sites on Crete, probably more important than Knossos, the very famous place, which is often associated with the myth of the Minotaur. Now, Gornia was this incredible town, a whole Minoan town that was being excavated, and the person in charge of that excavation was a woman called Harriet Boyd Hawes, an American. And in her team were two other women, Blanche Wheeler and Edith Hall. So on Crete, in one short period of time, was not one remarkable trailblazing woman, but four. I mean, that just changes this idea. I mean, the idea that Dorothea Bate was unusual, I mean, she was remarkable, yes, but she probably wasn't as unusual. And that simple fact irritated me a whole lot more than, I think, just this general idea of one woman being forgotten. Now, you can't expect every single person's name to be remembered forever. Most people couldn't name an archaeologist at all from that time period, male or female. But if you ask someone to picture an archaeologist, I think, from the early 1900s, they would picture a man, a white man, with a beard. That's basically what you'd come up with. And if you told them there was a woman, you'd think she was something strange, something unusual, something to be a kind of a curiosity. But actually, there were hundreds of them.
Well, now, hold on. I should probably, because you're quite right, I certainly couldn't name an archaeologist from that period, apart from Indiana Jones, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But what about your insider view? Is it the case that lots of names from that period are known and remembered and male?
Mostly. I mean, but the names that people do come up with are mostly men. And then the men are known better than the women. I think within the archaeology community, particularly when you're a specialist on the site, then you know all the names. But I think more broadly, I mean, for instance, there was a recent BBC programme called The Secret History of Archaeology. And it forgot the biggest secret, which was there were women working. It mostly referred to Mortimer Wheeler, who's a very famous and charismatic archaeologist who founded the Institute of Archaeology at UCL now. And he was a great TV personality. He was a real great popularizer. And so because of that, there's a lot of archives of him. And so, of course, it relied very heavily on that. But it did mention one woman in that setting, a woman named Kathleen Kenyon, and it referred to her as his assistant. Now, Kathleen Kenyon was the director of the Institute of Archaeology. She was more than somebody's assistant. She was an incredible and important figure in her own right. And she was one of actually Wheeler's protégés, but not Mortimer Wheeler, a woman called Tessa Wheeler, Mortimer Wheeler's first wife. And Tessa Wheeler used to really run the majority of these excavations, and it was really with her and Mortimer together that changed the face of archaeology and trained up an entire generation. They had this big excavation at a place called Maiden Castle in Dorset. If you look at the picture of that, it's mostly women excavating there, lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of young women coming through. This is all slightly later, this is the 20s, so Dorothea Bate's time slightly earlier. Even then, there are all these women working in the field. And that's what I think threw me, because it's one thing to forget one person's name, and it's a completely different, you can excuse that, right? You can say, okay, she was a rare individual, we can't remember everybody, of course these odd ones get forgotten. But when entire bodies of work, entire schools of people, the entire concept of that type of archaeologist has disappeared from the popular imagination, then we've got a problem. Because if you look at a paleontology department today, when we see ourselves as doing much better, there's still a problem with gender disparity. There are still mostly men in senior positions. There's a lot of young women coming up. They don't always make it through to permanent jobs. But even so, there's gender disparity. We've got an issue. We're not at gender parity at all. And it starts with like a very similar situation. You know, you've got quite a large number of women working, but who's going to remember us in 100 years' time, potentially, unless we all make the effort to redo it? Because these women were there and they were doing really good, important work. At the time, their colleagues and their male colleagues, some were dismissive, but most treated them as equals, intellectually at least. And yet we've just written them out en masse from history.
Now, these are the symptoms. What is the cause of this malaise?
I don't know, actually. I mean, a lot of it, I think, is because it's easier always to tell a lone hero myth, whether it's male or female. And so we cling to, it's much easier to tell that story than it is to tell about the sort of messy, kind of slightly tedious reality of how research works, which is large numbers of people working together. So it's always easier to focus on one individual and tell the story around them. And so on one hand, that works in favour of the people in power, so the people who make the big professorships, because they're the people who often, yeah, you tell, have a long and illustrious career and who have the power and the contacts to make the influences, leave their archives behind, and, you know, things like that. And then also, I think, because we have our own agenda, we think we also want to find these kind of unusual heroines in the past too. And so in some ways it helped, in some ways maybe we wrongly try to sort of exacerbate the difference by sort of saying how incredibly unique Dorothea Bate was, or look how extraordinary Mary Anning was, or things like that, because it makes a better story. But if you keep on digging down, there are a lot of women involved. Now, it is also really important to remember that before the 1950s, though, very few of these women had professional positions, but then very few of the men had professional positions. But quite often we refer to the men as scientists and the women as amateurs. So Mary Anning often gets referred to as an amateur paleontologist, but in fact, she was one of the few professionals around the time. She was making money out of her work. The rest were just gentlemen having fun around the edges of their fortunes. But yeah.
Well, I mean, you're very good humoured about it, but it seems atrocious to me that, and I think it does to you as well, that this kind of cultural amnesia is going on. I wonder if we could linger on that for a moment longer and try and understand. I don't quite buy into the idea of something along the line of the victors writing the history. It doesn't seem like it's a win-a-loser situation. I wonder if there's anything around the idea of women at a certain point in their career falling away for reasons of family, but it doesn't still really explain why their early work drifts away.
Not really for these earlier women. You can't use that as an explanation. Some of them, when they got married, had to leave their jobs because their husbands wanted them to, or because they weren't allowed to continue working. But actually, particularly before the 50s, when it wasn't a professionalised field so much, most of them didn't, because they were doing it as amateurs, and so they just kept on working. And most of them, actually, a lot of them didn't get married and didn't have children. There were some that did and some that didn't. So Harriet Boyd did get married and had kids, and continued working. I mean, they all did extraordinary things as well. Like, they were nurses in wars, and you know they were there. You know, they would just go out there and get their hands dirty and everything they could do. I mean, incredibly adventurous individuals from a very privileged background. I mean, I think that's a really important thing to remember, that there were conventions. It's not that it's good. I'm not trying to say that there wasn't any anti. They weren't having to face sort of barriers, but because most of them were from wealthy intellectual sets, there were fewer barriers to their participation than maybe we envisage. I mean, so they didn't have to make money, and they had their own money, and they could pretty much do what they wanted, and that solves a whole manner of prejudices half the time. And we should remember that today, because if we think we've got a gender problem in science, then we actually have a much bigger class problem, an ethnicity problem. I mean, it's a very, very, very white middle class, upper class field.
I'm glad to hear you say that, by the way. That class problem, I think, in very many areas is really a very great issue. I want to find the answer to this, but I don't think we're necessarily going to. But I can't quite believe that there isn't design going on there somewhere. It seems too remarkable otherwise, doesn't it?
Well, I suppose so, but lots of things look like they're designed and they just happened. So
look at
all of life, for example. But, it's one of those, I think it is one of those things, is that humanity is messy, society is complicated and cultures are complicated, and pinpointing a single cause is often maybe pointless. We want it, but there probably isn't one single thing. It's just all these confluences that happen and shape the way that we are today. And, I think it's... I think, personally, that there's an aspect of culture amnesia because for many, many years, women's contributions was considered to be less important. And so there was a kind of, so even though within their fields, these individual women would have been respected, I think outside of those fields, people were more likely always, as they often still today, to turn to a male expert over a female expert for the similar situation. And we see that evidence of that today as well. I mean, there's a difference between sort of what is a male expertise and what's a female expertise. You can see it all the time.
Could you give me an example of that?
I think this is probably a little bit controversial, but I suspect if you were a TV company or I don't know, trying to get a guest on a show, for example, and I think this has actually been sort of reported in other places, I think if you wanted to have a kind of a serious debate, Newsnight or something like that, they might be more likely to go for an older male academic on average. If you wanted to have a kind of light-hearted breakfast TV type of debate, they might ask for someone who's young and maybe female and bubbly or something like that, because of the different idea of settings. So I'm often the accessible face of science, I think, as opposed to the scary. I'm not very scary, unfortunately. I'd quite like to be, because it would challenge some stereotypes, but that's not who I am. But I mean, I'd always, I think, come across as the accessible face of science, and versus, say, I don't know, the cantankerous, serious, aging Don.
Well, you've mentioned age a couple of times there, though. Maybe that's an important factor.
Well, it is, I guess. We'll see if I manage to cling on in science to sort of hang on to I'm older, because that's a big problem as well. This is what we call the leaky pipeline. But yeah, no, people. I mean, for instance, I've been asked. I often get asked my age when journalists interview me, which I don't think they would ask my male colleagues. It's a bit weird. So.
Wow, when we came in, you've got a chaotic... I know your office isn't always chaotic. I'm certain of that. But it's at the moment, it's characterful, but very comfortable. But what I realise is that actually there's a lot of precariousness potentially in your profession, for you.
Of course, yeah. I mean, most people... I'm what's called an early career researcher. And most people at my stage in their scientific career, men and women, are on what's called fixed-term contracts. So we write grant proposals for projects and we apply for funding. And those funding, if it comes in, it funds our job. So I'm very lucky at the moment. I'm currently funded by the Leverhulme Trust, which is a charitable trust, until January 2016. But then after that, it's the next stop. It's about being freelance in some ways. So science is a very precarious profession in general. And it, you know, it can take a long time to get a permanent job, and actually very few people can, because there are an awful lot of people who do science PhDs. There's quite a bit of money for doing this, what we call postdocs, postdoctoral study, but less, and so there's a kind of a drop off there. But then the actual number of permanent jobs, so lectureships and professorships, things like that, it's a very, 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 very small number. So even the truly excellent may never, ever make it through to that stage. And yeah, so it's precarious. But I mean, I guess the downside is that you do this, and yeah, you jump through these hoops because you're fascinated, and like science, the questions, they get under your skin, and you want to know the answers, and that's what keeps you going. And so, you know, which is unfortunate, because it means you don't really have much bargaining power. Unionising is not an option. You're kind of, you know, you're a bit of a slave to the questions, and therefore you put up with this kind of stuff.
And if my understanding of education policy in the UK is halfway right, I think more people are being driven towards the sciences at the moment. There seems to be a move in that direction. And my understanding, I think, was that there are more females entering sciencey things very early on than there are male.
No.
Oh, is that not correct?
No, it's improving. It's improving. We still have some problems, particularly in chemistry and physics. So in the life sciences, yes, at undergraduate level, so life sciences and medicine, there's actually a swing in the other direction. There are more women at sort of degree level than there are men. It's interesting to see how that will translate into actual professional job levels, because, you know, if there's going to be a bias later on that might have an effect. But at the moment, life sciences are doing pretty well. In fact, you could almost argue we need to get more men back interested in them as well, because it's not good for anything anyway to not have diversity. But the chemistry and physics and maths and engineering, there's still a real problem there in terms of there being a big male gender bias and a lack of women and girls going into it. It's improving, but it's a real problem. And I mean, there are lots of potential reasons for that, I think, which all need to be addressed, and cultural ideas of what girls are good at, how we sort of socialise our kids from an early age to make them feel confident in certain situations and not in others. And there's good evidence to show that these things filter through. I mean, it's a ridiculous study. It makes you want to cry, actually. It's a good study, but it makes me, the outcome is just, it makes you, so it just feels so ridiculous. But apparently, if you ask a girl in the study, they ask these girls to identify their gender before doing a maths test, and some of them they didn't ask it for. And those that had to identify their gender, they did worse. This idea that the minute they thought of themselves as a girl, it's almost like their confidence, almost like that affected their ability to see themselves as being able to do maths. It was the interpretation. It's because we all have these kind of unconscious biases of what are male subjects and what are female subjects. I mean, somebody who, you know, is very passionate about the subject, I'm having to deal with my own unconscious biases as well, because I have them too. And you know, there's this test you can do online, I think to test your unconscious biases, and I was horrified. Mine came back with sort of, you know, 30% bias or something like that. It's awful.
It's true, isn't it? There's a reflexive thing. I've often noticed it. If you're a stereotypical man and woman in a room and something needs doing of a particular type, for example, if it's a child-related thing, then naturally the woman is turned to, or if it's a physical thing, then the man is turned to, and there's no rhyme or reason behind any of that in particular. Just a reflex that we need to overcome.
Yeah, exactly. And because, isn't it? And it's in both directions as well, because it's awful to think that little boys are being steered away from subjects that they might be fascinated or, you know, want to do for the same reason. So it's not good for anybody to have these kind of constraining ideas on their sort of intellectual and imaginative development. But I mean, I think the interesting, like, pushing people towards science, it's good to remember actually that I'm talking about a particular type of scientific career, which is the academic scientific career. That's not all of science. I mean, having an entire nation of individuals who have got this incredible knowledge about the way the world works, gleaned through understanding biology and chemistry and physics and maths and engineering, would be extraordinary if they went on to do other things that aren't academic science. From being an engineer, which can be anything from building space rockets down to designing the way a city should work. You know, these are fundamental things to planning like water usage in parts of the world that have got no water. I mean, that's a fundamental thing we need to sort out. That needs engineers. I mean, it's a really human need. They all need skills. These are jobs that people, practical jobs people can do. And actually, even just if you just did, you know, if you just don't want to do anything like that, but you want to have a nice quiet life, have an office job where you can work 9 to 5 and go home and have nice holidays and just, you know, have a nice comfortable family existence, still having that knowledge opens up your eyes to the world in a way which is just extraordinary. I mean, just knowing it makes you look at your city in a completely different aspect. So dragging it back to London, I would say I would say that paleontology, you know, it doesn't matter if you don't become a paleontologist at the end of it, just knowing that beneath your feet potentially are the bones of a mammoth or a hippo or a lion is just something which blows my mind, or which should blow anybody's mind. I mean, it's just extraordinary.
You're going to tell me if this is a stupid question, I hope. Is prehistory a booming business? What I mean by that, it strikes me that there are, of course, lots of new ways to understand the past. I don't know, just picking something at random, our understanding of genetics has obviously come in leaps and bounds in recent-ish years. But we're talking about advances in how we look back there. It seems to me there must be a finite and probably decreasing amount of stuff to find, right?
I think the more questions we ask, the more we realize we don't know, and so the more avenues that open up. Now, admittedly, obviously, the fossils themselves are a finite resource, like any kind of mineral that's in the ground. So if we dug them all out, then we would be, you know, we'd have no more digging to do. But we won't dig them all out, because we build on things, and there are always going to be new discoveries that turn up by chance. But once we've got those fossils, there's so much to be done with them. And as our technology improves, then whole new avenues of investigation open up. And that's a really important thing to remember as a scientist, because what that tells you is that yours will not be the last word on anything. You are only a tiny little blip in the incremental, hopefully, advance in our knowledge.
So you've got some of the same responsibilities as, I guess, a conservator. You've got to make sure that your investigations aren't destructive.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we do sometimes do destructive sampling, we call it. So take sections of fossils for analysis, for looking at the isotopic composition, or trying to get DNA out of them, or using looking for things like radiocarbon dating. They're all destructive methods, but we have to make sure we don't do so much damage there's nothing left. So for instance, like I mentioned, my project following the footsteps of Dorothea Bay is an exact example of that. When she was collecting, the scientific agenda was completely different. It was an age of discovery. They were just wanting to document the you know, the incredible diversity of the ancient world. So she went out with the agenda to collect things, and to collect things that were considered to be important for museums. And there was a kind of financial agenda as well, because she had to support herself financially and recoup the money of her trips. So she intended to do that by selling her fossils that she found back to the museum at the end of the trip, and that would then pay for her expenditure. It's kind of like sort of paleontological speculation, her expeditions. But of course, that affected the things that she collected. She didn't want to waste the energy and time in transporting back things that the museum wasn't necessarily going to buy. So she focused on the prime fossils, didn't collect everything as we would do now. And so she only got a small snapshot of the entire environment that her little dwarf mammoths and elephants she found lived in. And she wasn't interested in things like how old were they. She had no real concept of the complexity of the Ice Age. You know, we know it was much more complex with all these climate changes today. She didn't know that. She didn't also really have a true idea of the age or how long ago it was. I mean, she had a guesstimate, but she didn't have things like radiocarbon dating to rely on. And so she didn't make the same records at the beginning of her career, especially when she was still learning, that we really need to understand the context of where the fossils came from. So I have to go back to try and work that out now. And in places where she used dynamite and just explain... yeah, you can understand it, actually. Some of these Cretan sites are really rock hard. The rock's all cemented with the limestone and stuff. Oh, yeah, you can see why she turned to dynamite, because she wasn't interested in kind of preserving carefully what was there. That stuff is lost, and we'll never know the age of those fossils, which means there are all kinds of questions I won't be able to answer. If she'd left a bit behind, then we could have actually brought new methods to bear. And it's something which you always have to bear in mind. It's even as an amateur, like if you love fossil hunting and you want to go to, I don't know, along the cliffs of Dorset looking for ammonites, like, you know, following the footsteps of Mary Anning or someone like that, then if you find something incredible in the cliffs, like a plesiosaur, for example, do not tack it out. Leave it. Because if you can't do it properly, leave it for somebody who can. And when they take it out, hopefully they will leave enough behind that somebody later on will be able to interpret what they did. And now what would be best practice in an archaeological dig is to leave sort of sections in place so that people can go back and cross-check what you describe the stratigraphy to be. The stratigraphy is the layers of sediments that the fossils and archaeology finds are found in, so that people can come back and check and see what was going on and maybe do something with it in the future.
And you, let me just get my head clear, you'd recommend less dynamite these days?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Just a minimum amount necessary.
Yeah, yes. Rather wonderful image, isn't it, of this young Edwardian woman in her tweed with a sort of backpack full of dynamite scurrying along the cliffs of Crete.
It makes me wonder whether that isn't why her name has drifted into obscurity.
Oh, no. And actually, I would say Dorothea Bate has been rescued in many ways, partly by this. There's a really wonderful biography of her written by Carolyn Schindler, which you can still get if you Google. Discovering Dorothea is the name of the book, and it's a really wonderful, wonderful, wonderful book all about Dorothea Bate. Carolyn really brought her back to light, and so she's fairly well known, a bit like, not as well known as Mary Anning, but she even has in the Natural History Museum sort of front of house exhibition areas, we sometimes have an actress dressed up as her walking around or talking to kids. And so, you know, we've got a seminar room named after her, and we've got her specimens currently on display in the Mammoth exhibition and also in the Treasures Gallery here. So, you know, she's getting a bit. She's getting her due now. I mean, that is better. I think we're remembering her a bit more.
We're coming close to the end of our hour, and when your European holidays, funded by Leverhulme, come to their end in 2016, have you an idea what you might find yourself doing?
Hopefully, more sites. I've got to write another grant to get the funding. So, touch wood.
How would you like to be remembered at some distant point in the future? What would the ideal honour be?
Oh gosh, that's a terrible question. I don't know. I guess I'd like to be remembered for doing good, solid science. I think if people look back on my work and say, yeah, she contributed something that was worthwhile and stood the test of time, then that would make me happy. I'd be a bit sad if people looked at my work in 100 years' time and thought it was rubbish.
That seems like a modest ambition. We should say, of course, that there's a big noise being made at the moment about mammoths outside in Exhibition Road. You can't miss all the pennants hanging down, pointing into the Natural History Museum and mentioning mammoths. Are you involved in that side of things at all?
Partly involved in it. It's one of those things. Our research is part of the exhibition, so you can actually go and see within the exhibition itself, some of the fossils collected by Dorothea Bate from Crete, which I've worked on, and it was some of the work that we did on these fossils that she discovered that identified them as the world's smallest mammoth, which was kind of nice, and they're on display. But sadly, it finishes on the weekend of the 8th. However, what isn't closed and is still open until the end of September is another exhibition called 1 Million Years of Our Human Story, and it's all about the 1 Million Years of Britain, particularly a lot of it's from London because of course of this whole southern Britain bias. And you can go there and you can see these real fossils collected around the UK, and things like the hippo that was in Trafalgar Square. We've got I thought some elephants from Essex, Ilford mammoth, bits and pieces like that, which are well worth looking at. Boxgrove tibia of this human, so from Sussex, that's a very ancient human from Sussex, and the cast of those really old footprints I mentioned from Haysborough. It's a really wonderful exhibition, and that's until the end of the month, and that's definitely worth seeing, because I mean, if you're going to go and see the Hippopotames, this incredible sculpture that's floating in the Thames at the moment, it's really important to remember that whilst it seems like almost the antithesis of natural, this kind of pop art giant hippo floating there, 125,000 years ago, there actually would have been hippos in the Thames at that time. And you can see the real thing, the actual fossils, on display in the museum if you come here and look at them.
Well, the Natural History Museum does very well in terms of visitor numbers without any encouragement from us, but I hope, listener, that will give you an incentive to come along for now, and reluctantly, because I think there's just a little bit more to talk about in terms of the history of everything. Dr. Victoria Herridge, thanks very much.
Thank you very much. My heart aches for some
far off place. And that's all for this week. My thanks for this week to Victoria Herridge. Thanks too to Mark Barr and Bernie Barker. Theme and incidental music was by Songs from the Howling Sea. I'm in Quentin Wolfe.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.